Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind the headlines. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Joanne Freeman.
And I'm Nathan Connolly.
Each week, along with our colleague Ed Ayers, we explore a different part of American history. In this episode, though, we're going to bring you something a little different. An extended conversation between Brian, Nathan, and myself about a topic that has pretty much dominated the news over the last few days, impeachment.
If you need catching up, here's a brief rundown. On Tuesday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced she's launching a formal impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. The announcement comes after news of a phone call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in July. During the call, Trump requested Zelensky launch an investigation into his political rival and Democratic presidential contender, Joe Biden. Trump admits he talked about Biden with Zelensky. On Wednesday, the White House released a summary of the call, confirming the reports. And on Thursday, the House Intelligence Committee released a redacted version of the whistleblower complaint related to the call and the complaint that really made this whole episode public. Here's what Pelosi had to say about Trump on Tuesday.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections.
Meanwhile, Trump is condemning the investigation, calling it a witch hunt. And just a note, we recorded this episode on Thursday, but this continues to be a developing story.
If your head is spinning right now, know that you're not alone. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of talk about impeachment in U.S. history, which is why we wanted to do what we do best, offer some historical perspective.
So think of this episode as a kind of emergency roundtable on impeachment in the past, present, and possibly future of American history.
Why don't we go back, Joanne, to the very beginning, to the founders and the Constitution? What do they have to say about impeachment when they first drafted the Constitution?
Right. In this case, the most important thing to remember is that one of the main concerns of the framers was the channeling of power. And the Constitution really is a system of checks and balances about where power can go. And one form of power that they were really concerned about, and it's not surprising given that they had just won a revolution in which they'd revolted against a monarch that they felt was misusing power, was executive power. They were very worried about executive power. So they were certainly very concerned about having some sort of way to rein it in. And that's where the basic idea of impeachment comes from. And it's also partly why that process is divided between the House, which can bring charges essentially of impeachment, and the Senate, which acts as a jury. It's both houses of Congress. So it's part of a series of checks and balances. But what's interesting about it, there were not organized political parties when this idea of impeachment was being tossed around.
They didn't like parties, right? I mean, they thought it was a dumb idea.
Well, a dangerous idea. They thought that parties were a sign that people, surprise, were thinking about themselves and not the general good. So beginning years of the government, when it looked like parties were forming, that was a sort of alarm bell moment in the founding era. People thought, oh no, the whole thing's going down. We're forming political parties. So there wasn't an assumption that there would be wrestling when it comes to impeachment with the very sorts of things that in later years we have been wrestling with, which is what happens when one party controls one or both houses of Congress, another party has the presidency, and you have one of these moments in which, on the one hand, it has to do potentially with high crimes and misdemeanors, or it also has to do with partisan politics.
But there was an assumption about something we are wrestling with today very much, Joanne, and I want to get your views on this. I mean, they were particularly concerned about interference of foreign powers, right?
Yes. So if you project yourself back to that time period, you know, we were so new and powerless, and there were these major empires around the world with these imperious monarchs. So we didn't have power. And as a republic rather than a monarchy, what we were doing in the United States was experimental. So absolutely, there was fear all the time about, on the one hand, how foreign nations might interfere by messing with the popular part of politics. They could get the people riled up about something. Or that a president and a foreign power might find themselves entangled in some way, deliberately or otherwise. And that one or the other of those things essentially could take control of the American politics and, in a sense, worst of all, the American electoral process.
So obviously the founders are very good at thinking about process in a whole host of ways. And in the case of impeachment, I wonder what the process actually was as outlined by them.
Well, right. I mean, they did look across the ocean at England, which had its own sort of version of impeachment, usually applied to the king's ministers, not to the king himself. And in the British version of impeachment, the House of Commons would essentially bring charges. The House of Lords would act as a kind of jury and decide on the whole issue of impeachment. Now, the difference in England, if you're impeached, it's essentially a criminal charge. In the United States, the decision was, if you're fully impeached and the decision goes against you, you're removed from office and you can't hold public office again. So it's not a criminal charge in the United States as it was conceived at the time, but that touches on another issue, and that is very deliberately the account of what the crimes are that a president can do that merit impeachment are very general. They're very broad.
Right.
Tell us about the first time that all of this was really put into action big time with Andrew Johnson.
Right. And there are some interesting similarities between the impeachment of Andrew Johnson in 1868 and the present. This was during the moment of Reconstruction. There were what at the time would have been known as radical Republicans in Congress who were actively and aggressively trying to work towards Reconstruction. Johnson, as president, became president after the assassination of Lincoln, was basically, in one way or another, soft on the South, soft on the former Confederacy. And so there was a real rivalry, a real sort of back and forth between Congress and the executive. So already there was opposition between Congress and the president. The question was Congress going to do anything about it? And in the end, what provoked the impeachment was Johnson violates what was called the Tenure of Office Act, which had been passed just the year before, which said that the president can't dismiss Senate-approved government officials without congressional approval. So Johnson violates that by firing his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton. And although that sounds minor, it was kind of a way to open the door towards impeachment. And then other charges were added on. In the end, with the Senate acting as jury, he was not removed from office, and I believe it came down to one vote. It was not a straight partisan vote. People really thought hard about whether this seemed to merit removal from office. And because the law had some gray area in it, the Tenure of Office Act, they decided against it.
My understanding of the Johnson case in particular, and this feels at least like something that has some parallels with the 20th century examples, is that the real concern was about executive power. And that's not a partisan question, but it is one about the separation of powers and Congress really trying after the Civil War to be clear about the people still being largely in charge of how the government functions. And so to the point about embarrassing a chief executive, I think part of that energy and use of the impeachment power was about reminding, in some ways, the entire political system that the Congress is the broadest base of the political system and has like the broadest powers relative to how the other two branches function.
Absolutely.
Hello, I'm Diana Williams, the digital editor and strategist for Backstory. Every day, millions listen to podcasts and radio programs to learn, selecting the programs and hosts that suit their learning styles. From tenured academics in university studios to young hobbyists in bedroom closets, producers of educational audio are diverse but they share a common goal: to distill complex ideas into information that is free and accessible to everyone in the world. That's why Backstory is participating in the 2019 Sound Education Conference. It's a four-day event in Boston for educational podcasters and radio hosts and their listeners. Sound Education will take place from October 9th through the 12th and feature a wide variety of speakers, including me. I'll be talking about marketing on a budget. Sound Education is a unique chance to learn from and meet some of the smartest and most engaging voices in podcasting. Register for the Sound Education Conference at www.soundeducation.fm. www.soundeducation.fm.
So this actually leads me to think about, again, a president who wasn't impeached at all, but it in some ways helped set the stage for this modern presidency that we're now thinking through, which is someone like Franklin Roosevelt. You know, Roosevelt is someone who clearly has an extraordinary amount of power as a president. He needs Congress to execute the New Deal and certainly win the war, but it does kind of set a discussion in place about whether or not the Congress can reassert its power over the course of the 20th century. And obviously, you know, the example of Richard Nixon is used less as an example of congressional, you know, backlash than it is one about corruption in the White House. But again, the platform that Nixon has is in many respects, to your point, Joanne, the inheritance of a form of presidential politics that really does come to eclipse Congress as being the heart and soul of what American governance should work like.
And the really ironic thing there, Nathan, that's such a good point. The ironic thing is, of course, it's Congress that keeps urging the president to assume more powers during times of crises. It's like, you assert yourself, Mr. President, extending American authority around the globe after World War II in a nuclear age. You take care of that, Mr. President. That's like things moving a little too quickly for us in Congress. That's your job. And then there's that rebalancing moment. However, if the president is committing crimes or misdemeanors, if you will, under the impeachment power, that is a different kettle of fish than just the extension of executive power.
I would agree. I would agree. I mean, this again gets into some extraordinary gray space. I mean, you know, when you think about the various police actions of, you know, the Korean War and the Vietnam War, I mean, there were discussions about war crimes that were committed and whether or not those military actions can serve as crimes that can implicate a president and become impeachable. You know, that was never really considered to be a viable argument in the late 60s and early 70s, in spite of what many on the radical left might have been arguing for. And instead, what you have is, you know, the threat of impeachment in the early 1970s around tampering with the election process, right? That in some ways is more of a third rail, and we're seeing it clearly in the more recent example that's, you know, prompting our conversation, is that if you compromise the election process, now you've really gone a bridge too far. You know, there can be concerns about conflict of interest. There can be concerns about utterances out of the Oval Office that may alienate or target certain citizens. But when you tamper with the process by which the president is chosen, now we're really talking about something that is actionable. And that, again, it feels to me like there is a slight moral vagueness about what counts as crimes or misdemeanors, when in fact, you know, the real concern is about the integrity of the political system itself.
So, Nathan, you, of course, were referring to Watergate, where President Nixon was almost impeached. And certainly that began as an effort to corrupt the election. So I love the way you referred to, you know, the impeachments that didn't happen in terms of extension of executive power. And in the wake of Nixon, I think the impeachment that didn't happen is what Ronald Reagan did in what's known as Iran-Contra.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Because his people knowingly disobeyed the expressed intent of Congress. He violated congressional law. Through very stealthy means, he found a way to channel arms to these folks, the Contras, fighting in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And Congress had just said, we don't want to give them arms. So if fooling with elections is the third rail, bringing in interactions with foreign powers in secret it certainly intensifies the electricity running through that third rail.
Sure.
And that's what we have today, right? We've got charges of interfering with election through collusion with a foreign power. So, Nathan, I'm going to put you on the spot. Does the impeachment of Bill Clinton even compare to the Nixon impeachment or the charges against Trump today or those impeachments that didn't happen that we've referred to?
Right, right. Well, I mean, going right into the Reagan example, I mean, this is one of those things that I think is an important point to rest on for a moment, which is to say that who the Speaker of the House is matters in this case. So if Tip O'Neill is not seeing a political advantage or a moral argument that can, you know, help to do anything productive for whatever agenda he has in the early 1980s, then you're not going to see him try to, you know, shake hands and kiss babies and build the critical mass that would be necessary to proceed forward with an impeachment proceeding, right? The politics of Congress itself and of the Speaker, you know, him or herself, I think has a lot to say about whether these kinds of things wind up going forward.
And in that case, actually Trump, so to speak, partisan politics yet again, right?
Right, right.
O'Neill, a Democrat, Reagan, a Republican.
Absolutely. Now, you contrast that with someone like Newt Gingrich, who is clearly got deep, deep investment in embarrassing the Democratic Party, asserting a particular vision of Republican, you know, preeminence. And, you know, there's every reason in the world to imagine that, you know, someone who has been trying to outflank the GOP in going into some of its key electoral, you know, wellsprings, you know, thinking about the NASCAR dads, thinking about the tech sector, certainly reaching out to big, you know, capital and big finance. There was a lot about the Clinton presidency that was dangerous to the middle and long game of the Republican Party. And Gingrich, you know, even if they had moments of affability between Clinton and Newt, he was deeply invested in trying to build a long-term Republican majority. And there were a number of people who, for a whole host of reasons, who were going to get in line or on board with a Clinton impeachment for exactly these kind of partisan aims. And again, you get him on perjury, you know, you get him lying under oath, and that will be considered to be such an egregious offense relative to anything else the president has done that you can then create the spectacle of impeachment in order to discredit the presidency on moral grounds. And it's no accident that in 2000, the Republican Party's chief campaign point, even though, you know, Clinton escaped from the impeachment process, it was on the moral question, right? It was about bringing integrity back to the White House. George W. Bush ran on what was literally the political platter laid out by the Gingrich attempt to impeach Bill Clinton on moral grounds, which I find to be another fascinating way that impeachment turns into another generation of partisan politics.
Okay, so both of you guys, speaking as the non-20th or 21st century historian here, you know, living through this moment, everyone is saying, well, Watergate, Nixon, Watergate, you know, is this the same? Is it worse? Is it similar? How can we compare it? So that's my question to both of you, which is, in what ways is what we're seeing here worse? Because that appears to be what's emerging on a Thursday of this week, that perhaps what's happening here is worse. Is it? And how is our current circumstances and everything that's unique or distinctive about it, having to do with technology and media and everything else, what's your sense of how that's shaping what's going on at the moment?
Well, I think there are some parallels in the sense that in the year before Nixon resigns, I mean, he has a whole host of White House advisors who are making the arguments and trying to make the arguments that, you know, Nixon did not break any laws, that this is a very, you know, serious charge against the president, and they're not going to, you know, take such accusations lightly. And there's a real concerted pushback, I think, to the very nature of the charges directed against President Nixon, you know, along constitutional lines. Relative to the current situation with Donald Trump, you know, people are less invested in making the constitutional argument and rather simply invested in smearing the leftist media, right? Making it about a very skewed public conversation against the president, you know, located in a very small number of, you know, voices in the fourth estate. So they'll talk about the Times or CNN or the Washington Post as being biased against the president. So therefore, the charges are considered to be incredible. And I think that's a very different moment where people mm-hmm. in an earlier period, you know, are going to try to make this argument as legalistically as possible, whereas now it's just a matter of a larger, I think, bipartisan, or I should say, you know, bifurcated public arena on how we even get our perceptions of the presidency.
Yeah, I just want to add to what Nathan said about bifurcated. Bifurcated in several key ways, clearly more bifurcated in terms of partisan allegiance. Their members are far loyaler to partisan discipline. But one of the reasons for that is we are operating in a very, very different media landscape. The emergence of Fox News at the end of the 1990s, not really in full swing completely. It existed, but not in full swing even for the Clinton impeachment. The emergence of conservative talk radio. I think all of these have made it far more difficult to consider grave constitutional issues mm-hmm. on the substance of them, on their merits. And I do think we are operating in a very different world. And I do think the existing of that partisan allegiance, at least going in to this impeachment, means that it's going to be a lot harder for folks to change their views.
So that leads me to ask, you know, Brian, do you think Nixon would have resigned if there was a Fox News there barking the merits of his presidency?
No way, in my opinion. There right. is no way. I can be really strong in my opinion because there's no way we can know. I just don't think so. I think Nixon's entire strategy, you can see it in his changes in domestic policies. Nixon supported something that by today's terms was as radical as national policy for controlling land development. I mean, this mm-hmm. is pretty radical stuff. Mm-hmm. The next year, when he's under siege for Watergate, he backs off his support for that. Why? Because he had to hang on to the conservatives in his own party. They were the only people who were still supporting him and keeping him from being impeached. Mm. So had there been a way for him to go directly to the constituents of those conservatives and had his calculations about the forgotten American, the silent majority, had those been correct, had he been able to reach a broader public that really might have supported him through outlets mm-hmm. like Rush Limbaugh or right. Fox News, I just don't. Nixon resigning out of the goodness of his heart? I don't think so. I think he would have served out his term. All right, so I want to ask the two real historians in the room whether this feels like, you know, a really important historic moment.
Well, it does. I mean, there are levels of historic moment. You know, there have been other moments sure. in the recent past that I've been like, and this is going to sound very goofy, but I've basically been like, history is happening right now. Like, this is history. Yeah. But what's striking about this moment, and the only other moment I can remember thinking about the political process in this way, was actually during Clinton's impeachment. And that is, there are moments when something happens that happens so rarely, and impeachment is very much one of them. No one really absolutely knows how it's supposed to work. No one absolutely knows, like, what rooms do we go in, or who does what, or how does it work, or do we need right. a committee, or three committees, or one committee, and who's allowed to do what. And I remember back with the Clinton impeachment, watching people in Congress sort of work their way through, what are we doing? And right. it struck me because as a early American historian, that's all I write about. That was the whole tenor of government, was what the heck are we doing and how do we do it? And what are the implications of every way that we're considering doing it? And so this moment feels like one of those moments where it sort of strikes me in a deep guttural kind of a way, because we're feeling something we don't get to feel that often. And that is, huh, how does this process work? You know, what does it mean? And how are we going to work through it?
And where are we going to end up after it?
Yes, exactly.
Right. So mine feels historic in a slightly different way, and it connects back to, you know, that rhyming of history that we often, you know, talk about informally, which is to say the following. Like, you know, one of the things that is striking about the calls for impeachment that began very early in the Trump administration by Representative Al Green, a Democrat mm-hmm. from Texas, right, when he's calling from the House floor. And I remember so much of, you know, the chattering classes disdain of Green's calls for impeachment when it was only about the mistreatment of Puerto Rico after the hurricane, or only about the Trump's, you know, kind of tacit support of the Charlottesville protesters, or only about the transgender ban or the Muslim ban, right? I mean, there was a sense that not enough had really happened, and we were wringing our hands and waiting for the Mueller report to give us what we really needed to right. be able to impeach the president, right? And this feels very similar to me in terms of what was called for in, you know, the Nixon era, when all this discussion about, you know, Nixon's own politics, the dog whistle racial politics that right. were a part of that moment. You know, go back, you know, to the Johnson presidency, and there was no secret whatsoever that Johnson was, you know, opposed to the fate of the freedmen, right? And the radical Republicans knew it. But what did they get Johnson on for impeachment? It was his treatment of Stanton, right? It was the way that he managed the bureaucracy and a very senior official, you know. Again, Nixon got raked over the coals for dealing with the election in the way that he did. And
right.
now
process. It,
the process. But again, there seems to me to be a certain wisdom among populations who can see, you know, a troublesome chief executive from a ways off. And it winds up taking a little bit too long sometimes before that president just gets bolder and bolder and bolder to then like, oh, well, now we really have a problem. Right. And so, you know, I would hope that as we've talked over this conversation about the impact of the impeachment or the relationship between executive power and the Congress, that we come away from this moment with a sense that, like, maybe we should start to listen to some of these calls from the margin a little bit earlier. Right. Look at some of these red flags from populations that might not be considered the inside the Beltway, Washington mainstream or what have you, and really start to have a different set of criteria for evaluating those folks who get to occupy the Oval Office. Because if this moment feels like anything to me, it's a replay of impeachment theater that says, you know what, we kind of knew this person was a problem for a while, and now we're finally coming around to figuring this thing out.
Well, that's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode, or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org, or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.
Mom, Dad, I humbly suggest you save some money and shop Amazon for back to school. It's for my growth, meaning my body's growing at an alarming rate. And clothes you buy me this year will be very small, very soon. Plus, the clothes I love today will be out of style tomorrow. But at least your wallet doesn't have to be my fashion victim if you shop low prices for school at Amazon. Hopefully this is helpful. Amazon. Spend less, small more.
For a limited time, Comcast Business is introducing small business savings. Call now to save on powerful internet with no annual contract and a money-back guarantee. Call and start saving today. Comcast Business. Powering possibilities.
Restrictions apply.